Then let's forget what we should have done earlier, interrupted Farrell impatiently, and continue with what we should do now. In any case, what if we had imprisoned him or killed him? What then? We are not certain of his intentions even yet, and at the worst, we could not destroy an empire by snipping short one man's life. There might be navies upon navies waiting just the other side of his non-return. Exactly, approved the fourth man. Now, what did you get out of your captured ship? I'm too old for all this talking. It can be told in few enough words, said Farrell grimly. He's an Imperial general, or whatever rank corresponds to that over there. He's a young man who has proved his military brilliance, so I am told, and who is the idol of his men. Quite a romantic career. The stories they tell of him are no doubt half lies, but even so it makes him out to be a type of Wonder Man. Who are the they? Demanded the second man. The crew of the captured ship. Look, I have all their statements recorded on microfilm, which I have in a secure place. Later on, if you wish, you can see them. You can talk to the men yourselves, if you think it necessary. I've told you the essentials. How did you get it out of them? How do you know they're telling the truth? Farrell frowned. I wasn't gentle, good sir. I knocked them about, drugged them crazy, and used the probe unmercifully. They talked. You can believe them. In the old days, said the third man with sudden irrelevance, they would have used pure psychology. Painless, you know, but very sure. No chance of deceit. Well, there is a good deal they had in the old days, said Farrell dryly. These are the new days. But, said the fourth man, what did he want here, this general, this romantic Wonder Man? There was a dogged, weary persistence about him. Farrell glanced at him sharply. You think he confides the details of state policy to his crew? They didn't know. There was nothing to get out of them in that respect, and I tried, Galaxy knows. Which leaves us to draw our own conclusions, obviously. Farrell's fingers were tapping quietly again. The young man is a military leader of the Empire, yet he played the pretense of being a minor princeling of some scattered stars in an odd corner of the periphery. That alone would assure us that his real motives are such as it would not benefit him to have us know. Combine the nature of his profession with the fact that the Empire has already subsidized one attack upon us in my father's time, and the possibilities become ominous. That first attack failed. I doubt that the Empire owes us love for that. There is nothing in your findings, questioned the fourth man guardedly, which makes for certainty. You are withholding nothing? Farrell answered levelly, I can't withhold anything. From here on, there can be no question of business rivalry. Unity is forced upon us. Patriotism? There was a sneer in the third man's thin voice. Patriotism be damned, said Farrell quietly. Do you think I give two puffs of atomic emanation for the future Second Empire? Do you think I'd risk a single trade mission to soothe its path? But do you suppose Imperial conquest will help my business or yours? If the Empire wins, there will be a sufficient number of yearning carrion crows to crave the rewards of battle. And we're the rewards, added the fourth man dryly. The second man broke his silence suddenly and shifted his bulk angrily so that the chair creaked under him. But why talk of that? The Empire can't win, can it? There is Selden's assurance that we will form the Second Empire in the end. This is only another crisis. There have been three before this. Only another crisis, yes, Farrell brooded. But in the case of the first two, we had Salvor Hardin to guide us. In the third, there was Hober Mallow. Whom have we now? He looked at the others somberly and continued, Selden's rules of psychohistory, on which it is so comforting to rely, probably have as one of the contributing variables a certain normal initiative on the part of the people of the Foundation themselves. Selden's laws help those who help themselves. The times make the man, said the third man. There's another proverb for you. You can't count on that, not with absolute assurance, grunted Farrell. Now, the way it seems to me is this. If this is the fourth crisis, then Selden has foreseen it. If he has, then it can be beaten, and there should be a way of doing it. Now, the Empire is stronger than we. It always has been. But this is the first time we are in danger of its direct attack, so that strength becomes terribly menacing. Then if it can be beaten, it must be once again, as in all past crises, by a method other than pure force. We must find the weak side of its enemy and attack it there. And what is that weak side? Asked the fourth man. Do you intend advancing a theory? No. That is the point I'm leading up to. Our great leaders of the past always saw the weak points of their enemies and aimed at that. But now... There was a helplessness in his voice, and for a moment none volunteered a comment. Then the fourth man said, We need spies. Farrell turned to him eagerly. Right. I don't know when the Empire will attack. There may be time. Obermallow himself entered the Imperial dominions, suggested the second man. But Farrell shook his head. Nothing so direct. None of us are precisely youthful, and all of us are rusty with red tape and administrative detail. We need young men that are in the field now. The independent traders? Asked the fourth man. And Farrell nodded his head and whispered, If there is yet time. Chapter 3. The Dead Hand. Bel Rios interrupted his annoyed stridings to look up hopefully when his aide entered. Any word of the starlet? None. The scouting party has quartered space, but the instruments have detected nothing. Commander Hume has reported that the fleet is ready for an immediate attack in retaliation. The general shook his head. No, not for a patrol ship. Not yet. Tell him to double... Wait. I'll write out the message. Have it coded and transmitted by tight beam. He wrote as he talked and thrust the paper at the waiting officer. Has the Sewenian arrived yet? Not yet. Well, see to it that he is brought in here as soon as he does arrive. The aide saluted crisply and left. Rios resumed his caged stride. When the door opened a second time, it was Dukem Barr that stood on the threshold. Slowly, in the footsteps of the ushering aide, he stepped into the garish room, whose ceiling was an ornamented stereoscopic model of the galaxy, and in the center of which Bel Rios stood in field uniform. Patrician, good day. The general pushed forward a chair with his foot and gestured the aide away with a, That door is to stay closed till I open it. He stood before the Sewenian, legs apart, hand grasping wrist behind his back, balancing himself slowly, thoughtfully, on the balls of his feet. Then harshly, Patrician, are you a loyal subject of the Emperor? Barr, who had maintained an indifferent silence till then, wrinkled a noncommittal brow. I have no cause to love imperial rule, which is a long way from saying that you would be a traitor. True, but the mere act of not being a traitor is also a long way from agreeing to be an active helper. Ordinarily also true, but to refuse your help at this point, said Rios deliberately, will be considered treason and treated as such. Barr's eyebrows drew together. Save your verbal cudgels for your subordinates. A simple statement of your needs and wants will suffice me here. Rios sat down and crossed his legs. Barr, we had an earlier discussion half a year ago. About your magicians? Yes. You remember what I said I would do? Barr nodded. His arms rested limply in his lap. You were going to visit them in their haunts, and you've been away these 4 months. Did you find them? Find them. That I did, cried Rios. His lips were stiff as he spoke. It seemed to require effort to refrain from grinding molars. Patrician, they are not magicians. They are devils. It is as far from belief as the outer nebulae from here. Conceive it. It is a world the size of a handkerchief, of a fingernail, with resources so petty, powers so minute, a population so microscopic as would never suffice the most backward worlds of the dusty prefects of the dark stars. Yet with that, a people so proud and ambitious as to dream quietly and methodically of galactic rule. Why, they are so sure of themselves that they do not even hurry. They move slowly, phlegmatically. They speak of necessary centuries. They swallow worlds at leisure, creep through systems with dawdling complacence. And they succeed. There is no one to stop them. They have built up a filthy trading community that curls its tentacles about the systems further than their toy ships dare reach. For parsecs, their traders, which is what their agents call themselves, penetrate. Dukambar interrupted the angry flow. How much of this information is definite, and how much is simply fury? The soldier caught his breath and grew calmer. My fury does not blind me. I tell you I was in worlds nearer to Siwenna than to the Foundation, where the Empire was a myth of the distance, and where traders were living truths. We ourselves were mistaken for traitors. The Foundation itself told you they aimed at galactic dominion? Told me? Rios was violent again. It was not a matter of telling me. The officials said nothing. They spoke business exclusively. But I spoke to ordinary men. I absorbed the ideas of the common folk, their manifest destiny, their calm acceptance of a great future. It is a thing that can't be hidden, a universal optimism they don't even try to hide. The Siwenian openly displayed a certain quiet satisfaction. You will notice that so far it would seem to bear out quite accurately my reconstruction of events from the paltry data on the subject that I have gathered. It is no doubt, replied Rios with vexed sarcasm, a tribute to your analytical powers. It is also a hearty and bumptious commentary on the growing danger to the domains of His Imperial Majesty. Barr shrugged his unconcern, and Rios leaned forward suddenly to seize the old man's shoulders and stare with curious gentleness into his eyes. He said, Now, Patrician, none of that. I have no desire to be barbaric. For my part, the legacy of Siwenian hostility to the Imperium is an odious burden, and one which I would do everything in my power to wipe out. But my province is the military, and interference in civil affairs is impossible. It would bring about my recall and ruin my usefulness at once. You see that? I know you see that. Between yourself and myself, then, let the atrocity of 40 years ago be repaid by your vengeance upon its author, and so forgotten. I need your help. I frankly admit it. There was a world of urgency in the young man's voice, but Dukambar's head shook gently and deliberately in a negative gesture. Rios said pleadingly, You don't understand, Patrician, and I doubt my ability to make you. I can't argue on your ground. You're the scholar, not I. But this I can tell you. Whatever you think of the Empire, you will admit its great services. Its armed forces have committed isolated crimes, but in the main they have been a force for peace and civilization. It was the Imperial Navy that created the Pax Imperium that ruled over all the galaxy for 2,000 years. Contrast the 12 millennia of peace under the sun and spaceship of the Empire with the 2 millennia of interstellar anarchy that preceded it. Consider the wars and devastations of those old days and tell me if, with all its faults, the Empire is not worth preserving. Consider, he drove on forcefully, to what the outer fringe of the galaxy is reduced in these days of their breakaway and independence, and ask yourself if, for the sake of a petty revenge, you would reduce Siwenna from its position as a province under the protection of a mighty navy to a barbarian world in a barbarian galaxy, all immersed in its fragmentary independence and its common degradation and misery. Is it so bad? So soon? Murmured the Siwenian. No, admitted Rios. We would be safe ourselves, no doubt, were our lifetimes quadrupled. But it is for the Empire I fight. That and a military tradition which is something for myself alone, and which I cannot transfer to you. It is a military tradition built on the Imperial institution which I serve. You're getting mystical. And I always find it difficult to penetrate another person's mysticism. No matter. You understand the danger of this foundation. It was I who pointed out what you call the danger before ever you headed outward from Siwenna. Then you realized that it must be stopped in embryo, or perhaps not at all. You have known of this foundation before anyone had heard of it. You know more about it than anyone else in the Empire. You probably know how it might be best attacked. And you can probably forewarn me of its countermeasures. Come, let us be friends. Dukembar rose. He said flatly, "Such help as I could give you means nothing, so I will make you free of it in the face of your strenuous demand. I will be the judge of its meaning. No, I am serious. Not all the might of the Empire could avail to crush this pygmy world." "Why not?" Belrios's eyes glistened fiercely. "No, stay where you are. I'll tell you when you may leave. Why not?" "If you think I underestimate this enemy I have discovered, you are wrong." "Patrician," he spoke reluctantly, "I lost a ship on my return. I have no proof that it fell into the hands of the Foundation, but it has not been located since, and were it merely an accident, its dead hulk should certainly have been found along the route we took. It is not an important loss, less than the tenth part of a flea bite, but it may mean that the Foundation has already opened hostilities. Such eagerness and such disregard for consequences might mean secret forces of which I know nothing. Can you help me, then, by answering a specific question? What is their military power?" "I haven't any notion." "Then explain yourself on your own terms. Why do you say the Empire cannot defeat this small enemy?" The Sewenian seated himself once more and looked away from Rios's fixed glare. He spoke heavily. "Because I have faith in the principles of psychohistory. It is a strange science. It reached mathematical maturity with one man, Harry Seldon, and died with him, for no man since has been capable of manipulating its intricacies. But in that short period, it proved itself the most powerful instrument ever invented for the study of humanity. Without pretending to predict the actions of individual humans, it formulated definite laws capable of mathematical analysis and extrapolation to govern and predict the mass action of human groups. So, it was that psychohistory which Seldon and the group he worked with applied in full force to the establishment of the Foundation. The place, time, and conditions all conspire mathematically, and so inevitably, to the development of universal empire." Rios's voice trembled with indignation. "You mean that this art of his predicts that I would attack the Foundation and lose such and such a battle for such and such a reason? Are you trying to say that I am a silly robot following a predetermined course into destruction?" "No," replied the old patrician sharply. "I have already said that the science has nothing to do with individual actions. It is the vaster background that has been foreseen. Then we stand clasped tightly in the forcing hand of the goddess of historical necessity?" "Of psycho-historical necessity," prompted Barr softly. "And if I exercise my prerogative of free will? If I choose to attack next year, or not to attack at all? How pliable is the goddess? How resourceful?" Barr shrugged. "Attack now or never, with a single ship or all the force in the Empire, by military force or economic pressure, by candid declaration of war or by treacherous ambush. Do whatever you wish in your fullest exercise of free will. You will still lose. Because of Harry Seldon's dead hand, because of the dead hand of the mathematics of human behavior that can neither be stopped, swerved, nor delayed." The two faced each other in deadlock until the general stepped back. He said simply, "I'll take that challenge. It's a dead hand against a living will." Chapter 4. The Emperor. Cleon II, commonly called the Great, the last strong emperor of the First Empire, he is important for the political and artistic renaissance that took place during his long reign. He is best known to romance, however, for his connection with Belrios, and to the common man, he is simply Rios's emperor. It is important not to allow events of the last year of his reign to overshadow 40 years of Encyclopedia Galactica. Cleon II was Lord of the Universe. Cleon II also suffered from a painful and undiagnosed ailment. By the queer twists of human affairs, the two statements are not mutually exclusive, nor even particularly incongruous. there have been a wearisomely large number of precedents in history. But Cleon II cared nothing for such precedents. To meditate upon a long list of similar cases would not ameliorate personal suffering an electron's worth. It soothed him as little to think that where his great-grandfather had been the pirate ruler of a dust-speck planet, he himself slept in the pleasure palace of Amenetic the Great, as heir in a line of galactic rulers stretching backward into a tenuous past. It was at present no source of comfort to him that the efforts of his father had cleansed the realm of its leprous patches of rebellion and restored it to the peace and unity it had enjoyed under Stanel VI. That as a consequence, in the 25 years of his reign, not one cloud of revolt had misted his burnished glory. The Emperor of the Galaxy, and the Lord of All, whimpered as he lolled his head backward into the invigorating plane of force about his pillows. It yielded in a softness that did not touch, and at the pleasant tingle, Cleon relaxed a bit. He sat up with difficulty and stared morosely at the distant walls of the Grand Chamber. It was a bad room to be alone in. It was too big. All the rooms were too big. But better to be alone during these crippling bouts than to endure the prickling of the courtiers, their lavish sympathy, their soft, condescending dullness. Better to be alone than to watch those insipid masks, behind which spun the tortuous speculations on the chances of death and the fortunes of the succession. His thoughts hurried him. There were his three sons, three straight-backed youths full of promise and virtue. Where did they disappear on these bad days? Waiting, no doubt, each watching the other, and all watching him. He stirred uneasily. And now Broderick craved audience. The low-born, faithful Broderick. Faithful because he was hated with a unanimous and cordial hatred that was the only point of agreement between the dozen cliques that divided his court. Broderick, the faithful favorite, who had to be faithful, since unless he owned the fastest speed ship in the galaxy and took it to the day of the Emperor's death, it would be the Atom Chamber the day after. Cleon II touched the smooth knob on the arm of his great divan, and the huge door at the end of the room dissolved to transparency. Broderick advanced along the crimson carpet and knelt to kiss the Emperor's limp hand. "Your health, sire?" asked the Privy Secretary in a low tone of becoming anxiety. "I live," snapped the Emperor with exasperation. "If you can call it life, where every scoundrel who can read a book of medicine uses me as a blank and receptive field for his feeble experiments. If there is a conceivable remedy, chemical, physical, or atomic, which has not yet been tried, why then some learned babbler from the far corners of the realm will arrive tomorrow to try it. And still another newly discovered book, or forgery more like, will be used as authority. By my father's memory," he rumbled savagely, "it seems there is not a biped extant who can study a disease before his eyes with those same eyes. There is not one who can count a pulse beat without a book of the ancients before him. I'm sick, and they call it unknown. The fools! If in the course of millennia human bodies learn new methods of falling askew, it remains uncovered by the studies of the ancients and uncurable forevermore. The ancients should be alive now, or I then." The Emperor ran down to a low-breathed curse, while Broderick waited dutifully. Cleon II said peevishly, "How many are waiting outside?" He jerked his hand in the direction of the door. Broderick said patiently, "The Great Hall holds the usual number." "Well, let them wait. State matters occupy me. Have the captain of the guard announce it. Oh, wait. Forget the state matters. Just have it announced I hold no audience, and let the captain of the guard look doleful. The jackals among them may betray themselves." The Emperor sneered nastily. "There is a rumor, sire," said Broderick smoothly, "that it is your heart that troubles you." The Emperor's smile was little removed from the previous sneer. "It will hurt others more than myself if any act prematurely on that rumor. But what is it you want? Let's have this over." Broderick rose from his kneeling posture at a gesture of permission and said, "It concerns General Bel Rios, the military governor of Siwenna." "Rios?" Cleon II frowned heavily. I don't place him. Wait. Is he the one who sent that quixotic message some months back? Yes, I remember. He panted for permission to enter a career of conquest for the glory of the Empire and Emperor. Exactly, sire. The Emperor laughed shortly. Did you think I had such generals left me, Broderick? He seems to be a curious atavism. What was the answer? I believe you took care of it. I did, sire. He was instructed to forward additional information and to take no steps involving naval action without further orders from the Imperium. Safe enough. Who is this Rios? Was he ever at court? Broderick nodded, and his mouth twisted ever so little. He began his career as a cadet in the Guards 10 years back. He had part in that affair off the Lemel Cluster. The Lemel Cluster. You know, my memory isn't quite... Was that the time a young soldier saved 2 ships of the line from a head-on collision by... something or other? He waved a hand impatiently. I don't remember the details. It was something heroic. Rios was that soldier. He received a promotion for it, Broderick said dryly, and an appointment to field duty as captain of a ship. And now military governor of a border system, and still young. Capable man, Broderick. Unsafe, sire. He lives in the past. He is a dreamer of ancient times, or rather, of the myths of what ancient times used to be. Such men are harmless in themselves, but their queer lack of realism makes them fools for others. He added, His men, I understand, are completely under his control. He is one of your popular generals. Is he? The Emperor mused. Well, come, Broderick. I would not wish to be served entirely by incompetence. They certainly set no enviable standard for faithfulness themselves. An incompetent traitor is no danger. It is rather the capable men who must be watched. You among them, Broderick? Cleon II laughed and then grimaced with pain. Well, then, you may forget the lecture for the while. What new development is there in the matter of this young conqueror? I hope you haven't come merely to reminisce. Another message, sire, has been received from General Rios. Oh, and to what effect? He has spied out the land of these barbarians and advocates an expedition in force. His arguments are long and fairly tedious. It is not worth annoying your Imperial Majesty with it at present, during your indisposition, particularly since it will be discussed at length during the session of the Council of Lords. He glanced sidewise at the Emperor. Cleon II frowned. The Lords? Is it a question for them, Broderick? It will mean further demands for a broader interpretation of the Charter. It always comes to that. It can't be avoided, sire. It might have been better if your august father could have beaten down the last rebellion without granting the Charter. But since it is here, we must endure it for the while. You're right, I suppose. Then the Lords it must be. But why all this solemnity, man? It is, after all, a minor point. Success on a remote border with limited troops is scarcely a state affair. Broderick smiled narrowly. He said coolly, It is an affair of a romantic idiot. But even a romantic idiot can be a deadly weapon when an unromantic rebel uses him as a tool. Sire, the man was popular here and is popular there. He is young. If he annexes a vagrant barbarian planet or two, he will become a conqueror. Now, a young conqueror who has proven his ability to rouse the enthusiasm of pilots, miners, tradesmen, and such like rabble is dangerous at any time. Even if he lacked the desire to do to you as your august father did to the usurper Ricker, then one of our loyal lords of the domain may decide to use him as his weapon. Leon II moved an arm hastily and stiffened with pain. Slowly he relaxed, but his smile was weak and his voice a whisper. You are a valuable subject, Broderick. You always suspect far more than is necessary, and I have but to take half your suggested precautions to be utterly safe. We'll put it up to the Lords. We shall see what they say and take our measures accordingly. The young man, I suppose, has made no hostile moves yet. He reports none, but already he asks for reinforcements. Reinforcements? The Emperor's eyes narrowed with wonder. What force has he? This book is continued on cassette number 2.